CKUT's 2020 funding drive has been postponed indefinitely, but we are still accepting donations to help us sustain the station's operations while we remain closed due to COVID-19. Our wide network of volunteers provides an essential service to many different communities in Montreal, and the isolation of the past few months has highlighted how important independent news, arts and culture, and music programming is for Montreal's underrepresented communities. If you are in a position to give during this time, visit ckut.ca and click on the green Donate button to make a contribution, or contact funding@ckut.ca if you have any questions. Thank you for your continued support. Love, CKUT.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Anti-Semitism is on the rise today. It's real and it's a threat to Jewish communities. Fighting it is a must. Knowing what anti-Semitism is and how to identify it is important if we're going to fight it. But currently, there is an organized effort to conflate anti-Semitism with legitimate criticism of Israel. The International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, or the IHRA's definition, does just that. The IHRA is an intergovernmental organization of 34 member countries. Pro-Israel lobby groups are pushing universities, governments, municipalities, and other organizations to adopt the IHRA's definition. The IHRA's definition could have disastrous consequences for anyone who stands for Palestinian human rights, or anyone who cares about freedom of expression or academic freedom. Here are four reasons why you should oppose the IHRA's definition of anti-Semitism. The IHRA's definition of anti-Semitism has little to do with actual anti-Semitism. Its goal is to stifle legitimate criticism of Israeli state policy. 7 out of the 11 examples of anti-Semitism listed in the IHRA's definition specifically mention Israel. If the IHRA is really about combating anti-Semitism, which is hatred against the Jewish people, why the disproportionate focus on Israel? Anti-Semitism is real and deadly. The IHRA's definition is vague and confusing. Attacks against the Jewish people in North America are commonplace and often have tragic consequences. The IHRA's definition of anti-Semitism fails to identify anti-Semitism as a form of prejudice, instead calling anti-Semitism a certain perception of Jews, which may be expressed as hatred. What does that mean? To fight anti-Semitism, we need clear and strong tools. The IHRA's definition is anything but that. The IHRA's definition of anti-Semitism actually makes Jews and Palestinians more vulnerable. It makes Jews more vulnerable by conflating anti-Semitism with legitimate criticism of Israel. And it makes Palestinians more vulnerable by threatening their very legitimate fight for human rights. In the United States and in England, the IRA's definition is already being used to silence the Palestine Solidarity Movement. In the US, President Trump signed an executive order adopting the IRA's definition into law. It could be used to withhold federal funds from universities where students and faculty are heavily involved in fighting for justice and peace in Palestine. In Canada, the Ontario government has tabled a bill to adopt the IRA's definition. Several municipalities, including Vancouver and Calgary, have tried and failed to adopt it. It is essential to stop the weaponization of anti-Semitism and the repression of Palestine solidarity. We need to stop the IRA's definition from being implemented. But what can we do about it? IJV has our own better definition of anti-Semitism. We recognize where the real hate is coming from. Fascists, the far right, and other hate mongers, not human rights activists. Plus, we clearly define anti-Semitism as a form of bigotry that's linked to other forms, like white supremacy and Islamophobia, because anti-Semitism cannot be fought in isolation. We need to fight it together, because together we are stronger. Fight anti-Semitism and white supremacy, not freedom of expression. No IRA.
Thank you so much for joining us today, where we'll be discussing the IHRA working definition of anti-Semitism and its implications for folks in Ontario. The Palestinian Youth Movement proudly presents this webinar along with our partners, Independent Jewish Voices, Faculty for Palestine, and the Toronto BDS Network. So my name is Dahlia, and I'm here on behalf of the Palestinian Youth Movement. Tonight, we'll be discussing the IHRA's working definition of anti-Semitism and how it will affect the movement for Palestinian rights and academic freedom with the recent passing of the IHRA by an order in council in Ontario to bypass the democratic process of hearings and testimonies in the Standing Committee on Justice Policy. The IHRA has been used in several countries to stifle speech on Palestine and to silence scholarship of academics, activists, and professors. So to introduce our panelists, we have today Dr. Cheryl Nestle, an activist, author, and retired sociologist specializing in critical race studies. She is a member of the National Steering Committee of the Independent Jewish Voices in Canada. Our second panelist is Faisal Baba, who is an associate professor at Osgoode Hall Law School of York University, where he teaches courses on constitutional law, human rights, legal ethics, and employment law. Our panelist, Dr. Greg Shupak, he writes fiction and political analysis and teaches English and media studies at the University of Guelph, Humber, and is the author of the book, The Wrong Story, Palestine, Israel, and the Media. And last but not least, our final panelist, Dr. Nahla Abdo, is an anti-colonial, anti-racist feminist, political activist, and professor of sociology at Carleton University. She has extensive publications on anti-colonial, anti-imperialist feminism, and the settler colonial state, with specialization on Palestine. And so that is our panelists for today. So we're gonna start with each panelist giving us around 10, 15 minutes intro. So go ahead, Dr. Cheryl Nestle, please.
Hey, I wanna thank all the people who came together to put this together. It's been really energizing working with the PYM and our other partners on this. And of course, there's so much going on that it's a wonderful opportunity for us to be able to speak about what's going on. First, I want to say that the Canadian opposition to the IHRA working definition of anti-Semitism has been the strongest and most effective in the world. We've been told this from our international partners. Everyone is in awe of what we managed to accomplish. IJV, Independent Jewish Voices, has laid some of the groundwork for this, but I think that the real test has been our recent coalition building efforts against the IHRA and against the Ontario government's efforts to pass the IHRA as law. We have demonstrated that we can take on powerful pro-Israel groups and lobbies and the institutional Jewish community and the politicians who dance to their tune. This is quite a claim, and I think we need to be extremely proud of what we've done. And I think that this can serve as a model for other struggles against the IHRA around the world. My job here is to give you a brief, among others, to give you a brief history of the IHRA. Some of you may not have the full picture. I recommend that if you really want to Buckle Down and Study It, go to www.noihra.ca for a full range of opinions and articles. And IJV has produced a 39-page critique of the IHRA definition, which Brian Klug, who I'll mention later, who is a professor of philosophy at Oxford and a big activist against the IHRA, said is the most comprehensive document he's seen critiquing the IHRA. So I highly recommend that. So I'm going to do this really briefly. The definition was originally developed by the European Monitoring Committee on Racism under the auspices of the American Jewish Committee, which not everybody knows. And it was created for the purpose of research, for having a definition that would allow researchers to actually adjudicate whether something was anti-Semitic or not. It includes a brief, vague definition and 11 examples, 7 of which have to do with criticism of Israel. It was embraced by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance in 2016, and a campaign to have it adopted by governments, police, universities, and other agencies was launched. Brian Klug, who I mentioned before, who is a staunch opponent of the IHRA, suggested the definition did not catch on in the early 2000s. It caught on once the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance took it on. And, you know, Brian has argued that that this link rendered opposition to the IHRA as tantamount to Holocaust denial, that the very name of Holocaust in this definition and its change actually made it a much more effective tool. And this is undoubtedly one of the reasons it's been so successful. The IHRA has been promoted vigorously by the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which has spent tens of millions of dollars fighting initiatives like we all stand behind, such as BDS. And it's been taken up and promoted by every major Jewish organization in the world. It's been adopted by 30 plus countries, members mostly of the IHRA itself, and recently by Bahrain and Albania, go figure. And it's been adopted by a few municipalities in Canada and has been defeated in several places, mainly through the efforts of IJV and its allies, mainly in Vancouver, Calgary, and Montreal, which are very major places. And recently in Brampton, it was adopted, but without the examples, which we consider to be a victory. Okay, the IHRA, just to give you an example of how it's been used. It's been used, it was the basis of the Trump's 2018 executive order is being used to adjudicate civil rights complaints against Palestine solidarity activists on 14 U.S. campuses. In the U.K., it was used to shut down a bike ride to raise money for Palestinian children and was central in the debate within the British Labour Party, which, as we all know from this week, ultimately wound up expelling Jeremy Corbyn from the party. We are hearing now that the British government is telling universities in England that if in the United Kingdom, if they do not adopt the IHRA by the end of the year, they risk defunding, which is probably one of the most threatening things that we've heard around the IHRA. Germany has been particularly aggressive in the use of the IHRA, and one of its most well-known cases was the case against Achille Mbembe, the famous political theorist, and the conference that he was supposed to speak at, there were complaints, and ultimately the conference was shut down because of COVID, but not before Mbembe took a lot of flack for his comparison of Israel to South African apartheid. So who is that's who's for the IHRA? Who's opposed to the IHRA? Kenneth Stern, the man who wrote the definition, claims that it's being used for purposes for which it was not intended. 244 academics in the UK, the British Columbia, you know, I'm actually not going to waste my time by going through everyone. You can go to the NOIHRA website and see all the organizations, including the American Civil Liberties Union, the Center for Constitutional Rights, National Lawyers Guild in Canada. Many major labor unions have joined this strike, this fight. The New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Washington Post have all come out against the IHRA. The Quakers are against the IHRA. I want to tell you a few interesting developments. In the last few months, I've been involved with three international anti-IHRA initiatives. One is a group that I helped organize of 17 Jewish groups from 14 different countries who have come together for mutual support and to be able to have a Jewish voice, a collective Jewish voice against the IHRA that goes beyond the US and Canada. Jewish Voice for Peace in the United States has launched an international effort as well, which goes beyond Jews and involves Palestine solidarity activists from around the world. And it's a very exciting initiative. There's also a group working on an alternative definition of the IHRA for definition of anti-Semitism that will hopefully be able to be used to as an alternative to the IHRA. And I think that what's important in this listing here is that it attests to the fact that the IHRA is not universally accepted, which is one of the claims that's made over and over again. I want to talk a bit. My involvement with these international groups has been interesting. And one of the things that I've been thinking about and found that other people have been thinking about is broadening our talking points, broadening our critique of the IHRA definition to include understanding the IHRA definition as itself a racist document. And I just want to go quickly through what the arguments are here. The first one is that by demanding special legislation against anti-Semitism, the IHRA prioritizes Jews and anti-Semitism against over other forms of racism. So it divides the struggle against racism, against anti-Semitism, from the struggle against racism more broadly construed. And that, I think, is very problematic. It's destructive, it's ahistorical, it's divisive, and ultimately will be ineffective. Further to this, there's a common perception, and I'm going to get myself into trouble here because I'm going to say things that are going to be pretty controversial, but there's a common perception circulated widely in the form of the B'nai B'rith audit, annual audit of anti-Semitic events, which is widely quoted. A headline on a recent press release, the 2019 press release, screamed, "Canadian Jews most targeted group for third year in a row." The actual statistic, according to StatsCan, is that Jews are the most targeted religious group in Canada, suffering 19% of all hate crimes. However, police reported incidents linked to race and ethnicity, not to religion, constitute 44% of all hate crimes. So I don't understand how you can make a claim that Jews are the most targeted group. It doesn't make any sense unless you add most targeted religious group. And these numbers have to be seen in light of the fact that people from groups who tend to trust the police are more likely to report hate crimes than those who do not. And we know from academic research that racialized communities and immigrants, as a rule, may not trust police and are less likely to report. So our picture that we have is certainly not complete. It's also important to understand that in their annual audit of anti-Semitic incidents, B'nai B'rith uses the IHRA definition to vet the complaints. So people can give their complaint on a 24-hour hate line run by B'nai B'rith. And just to give you a sense of how convoluted the statistics that they've come up with are, in their last year, the audit reported 2,207 anti-Semitic incidents, 91% of which were harassment, and 81% of which were online. For the same year, the Anti-Defamation League, no angel itself, which does not use the IHRA, reported 2,107 anti-Semitic incidents. The U.S. has 15 times the number of Jews that Canada does, which render the B'nai B'rith statistic at the very least methodologically flawed. So I'm in no way saying that anti-Semitism in Canada is inconsequential. Hate is never inconsequential. But when we look at the U.S., when we look to the U.S. and to Europe, we're confronted with multiple violent anti-Semitic attacks. These attacks are terrifying and they demand our response. However, we need to acknowledge that every context is different and requires its own set of analyses and strategies. What we need in order to respond to anti-Semitic hate is not moral panic, but accurate and reliable data, which I claim we do not have. A second point on racism in the IHRA. Anti-Palestinian racism is at the heart of the IHRA. Since it claims Jewish self-determination in Israel-Palestine as a fundamental right, but suppresses the Palestinian narrative. So the IHRA definition completely obscures the fact that Jewish self-determination is entirely has been achieved through the denial of basic human rights to Palestinians. Excuse me. Another point is that we have seen those who are most persecuted for pro-Palestine speech are racialized scholars and activists. So the list is long but significant. I won't give you all of them. But Angela Davis, Linda Sarsour, Mark Lamont Hill, Achille Mbembe, Rabab Abdulhadi of San Francisco State, and our very own Faisal Baba, who was attacked by B'nai B'rith after he participated in a webinar on the IHRA in June. I was also on that webinar, and while I said many of the same things that Faisal said, I did not get attacked. He did. Finally, and I'm going to end here, by ignoring the most frequent source of anti-Semitism, white supremacy, and by equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, the IHRA deflects attention away from anti-Semitism, for actual anti-Semitism. And this is something we cannot afford. Thanks.
So now we'll be hearing from our next speaker, Faisal Baba.
Hi, everybody. Thanks to the organizers for putting together this panel and for the opportunity to share some thoughts. Initially, I was preparing to talk about Bill 168 and what it means and what will happen should it be adopted, which seemed certain at the time that we were discussing that. And so I've adapted what I was going to say because I think some of those questions still remain. But I think the title of this panel raises a relevant question, which is the question of, is Zionism racism? But that's not the question today. The question today is whether it is lawful in Ontario to say that Zionism is racism. And just to start, I mean, I think that the fact that this question needs even to be posed and answered speaks to the crisis in, yet surprisingly, perhaps unsurprisingly for some, no one on the talking about it. Why? Well, because the kind of speech that is under attack is pro-Palestinian speech, and the people whose freedom is being chilled are Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, and their allies on the political left. Right-wing free speech defenders apparently only care about right-wing speech. While any attack on political speech undermines democratic values, broadly speaking, the primary casualty of selective free speech restrictions on Palestinians is Palestinians themselves, and in particular, their right to equality. Individual and collective expressions of social, cultural, and political messaging have been demonized. Palestinian culture, religion, and political aspirations have been thoroughly smeared with Islamophobic and racist stereotypes, such that nonviolent opposition to human rights violations gets falsely labeled as hate speech or sympathy for terrorism. The popular call for BDS has been disparaged as bigoted. The effect of these kinds of smears and false characterizations has been to increase the levels of hate and discrimination that Palestinians and their supporters face. Last November, for example, a group of pro-Palestinian students protested an event featuring former Israeli soldiers at York University, where I teach. The demonstrators have been found by an independent investigation to have been faced with violence committed by members of the Jewish Defense League, the JDL, a right-wing hate group, which has now been banned from York University. Yet the university condemned not the racist attackers for their attack, but rather the protesting students for so-called anti-Semitism. So did the mayor, the premier, and the prime minister. The suppression of speech in favor of Palestinian human rights is not just a free speech issue. It's also a racism issue. There's no other way to explain the persistent and targeted silencing of Palestinian voices and perspectives. Okay, so back to the question, is it lawful in Ontario to say that Zionism is racism? Well, under Bill 168, the proposed Combating Anti-Semitism Act of 2020, this would have adopted the IHRA working definition of anti-Semitism into Ontario law in a way which would have required the government of Ontario to be guided by the working definition and the illustrative examples as well. It also would have amended the Legislation Act to define anti-Semitism to mean the IHRA working definition, including the illustrative examples, anytime that that term is used in legislation or regulation. So to be clear, none of this created any sort of criminal offense or actionable civil wrong. It didn't change the law to permit the police to charge somebody with anti-Semitism or for people to sue each other for anti-Semitism. But it is quite likely that the effect of Bill 168 would have been to create a highly persuasive, if not binding, definition of anti-Jewish discrimination and harassment within the meaning of the Ontario Human Rights Code, for example. And this would be significant because discrimination is not defined in the code. Courts and tribunals have the authority to interpret discrimination based on a set of considerations. Bill 168 would have potentially removed some of that discretion and required decision makers to factor in the IHRA definition, including the illustrative examples, whenever called upon to determine whether something constituted discrimination. That, no doubt, would have led to a chill on Palestinian thought and expression. So, for example, imagine a business owner expressing the view in the workplace that Zionism is racism. This person may be a child of a refugee who is driven out of their ancestral homeland, prohibited from returning simply because they're not Jewish. For this person, the racism of Zionism would be more than just an intellectual idea. It's a lived experience. It's an intergenerational trauma. Preventing Palestinians from openly discussing their own lived experience is just one of the many ways in which Palestinians are uniquely dehumanized. No other community that I can think of in this country has their national expressions maligned in this manner and to such a degree. Imagine then that Palestinian business owner has an employee or a customer who hears the comment and alleges that this constituted discrimination on the basis of their creed, ethnic, or national origin. The customer or the employee claims that their commitment to Zionism is a central aspect of their Jewish identity, which they say is insulted and denigrated by the equation of Zionism with racism. The idea that building and maintaining the state of Israel as the state of the Jewish people as a racist endeavor is believed by that person to be anti-Semitic because Jews in Israel are believed to be inextricably entangled. And because the comment was communicated in a workplace providing services to the public, the effect would have been demeaning, caused the employee or the customer to feel less safe and unwelcome. The employer's stated political viewpoint would be interpreted as saying, essentially, Jews are not welcome in this workplace. And under Bill 168, there would have been very little doubt that if the employee had commenced litigation for discrimination, an adjudicator would likely have viewed itself to be bound by the illustrative examples, and thereby bound to conclude that such an incident would be a violation of the Human Rights Code. Thankfully, the legislative process for Bill 168 has halted and will almost certainly die on the committee floor. But what we now have is what happened a week ago. The Lieutenant Governor in Council signed an order in Council which adopts and recognizes the IHRA working definition, but it makes no specific reference to the illustrative examples. This is in stark contrast to Bill 168 and has led most experts to conclude that the exclusion is consequential. It reflects an intention to remove any explicit reference to the illustrative examples. It means that a political choice was made to keep them out. Legally speaking, the OIC has limited legal impact. It's not legislation. It's executive decree with limited purpose. It can't be used to bind, any member of the public on its own. It only binds government. But the OIC can operate as a signal to the public about how the government intends to govern itself in terms of its interpretation of anti-Semitism. Just because the OIC doesn't make specific reference to the illustrative examples doesn't mean that the illustrative examples can't be considered by individuals or agencies that are acting pursuant to the OIC. The government has not explicitly committed itself to not using the illustrative examples in its interpretation of anti-Semitism. In any event, even without the OIC, the government or any individual or group could choose to use the IHRA working definition with or without its illustrative examples. In fact, this is what was happening before the OIC, and it's what is continuing to happen after the OIC. Yet, just yesterday, B'nai B'rith reported that the Toronto restaurant Food Benders is now facing a municipal investigation of its business license in response to a complaint pursuant to a bylaw that provides that a business must not be used to discriminate against any member of the public. Food Benders is alleged to have called Zionists Nazis, amongst other things, and there's already a complaint before the Human Rights Tribunal about that. No doubt the decision by the City of Toronto to investigate Food Benders was taken as a result of aggressive lobbying by B'nai B'rith, which would have started well before the OIC was signed last week. that push would have occurred and would have continued to occur with or without the law, with or without the OIC, with or without Bill 168. No doubt these legal changes would have affected and impacted the advocacy strategy. But the point I'm making is that groups like B'nai B'rith are going to continue to push for their maximum interpretation of maximum influence of the IHRA definition and the illustrative examples. Whether they get their way in law or not, they're going to say what they want to say, and they're going to push it through advocacy channels. So what I've been trying to illustrate to sum up is that the question of legality, while interesting and relevant, is not and should not be the determinative factor in deciding what is needed by way of action. Whatever the law is or says, the intellectual and policy debates that occur in the public, in academia, and in politics are far more important. So much public discourse now occurs on social media, which is a deeply flawed medium for nuanced thought. But this is where the signals of approval and disapprobation of ideas are made and won. Bureaucrats, administrators, and institutional leaders are easily swayed by public opinion. The decisions that matter will be taken at the micro level, often far away from the public eye, whether to extend a job offer or an invitation to speak or to grant funding to a project or a government contract. The Palestinians have many silent supporters, and that's proven by formal and informal surveys, which show that most Canadians are far less anti-Palestinian than Canadian policy appears to be, and certainly than the Israeli lobby is. But also, for most, the Palestinian cause is not a major issue of public policy. And so this is why it's important to continue to insist on exposing and confronting the broader undemocratic tendencies of the Israel lobby as a way to activate the broader public into seeing this not just as a Palestinian or Middle Eastern issue, but as a Canadian issue that risks diminishing fundamental rights and freedoms. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Cheryl and Faisal so far. So our next speaker is going to be Dr. Greg Shupak.
Thank you. So my colleagues and comrades here have already demonstrated that one of the IHRA's, or that the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism is frankly untenable. And my remarks will be concerned here with what this indefensible approach to the idea of anti-Semitism, what this indefensible approach means for post-secondary education. And I'm including under that rubric both for academics and for students. So I'll begin by commenting on a few immediate practical concerns that arise from applying the IHRA definition to educational institutions. First, it cannot be stressed enough that we're not talking about a hypothetical problem. Students and scholars critical of Israel and Israeli policies have long been subjected to smears and innuendo suggesting that anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism are equivalent. You know, in September, as many of you know, and as was just mentioned, a scholar by the name of Valentina Azarova had a job offer to U of T's law school rescinded, almost certainly because of her, frankly, very measured objections to Israeli conduct in the occupied Palestinian territories. So what the IHRA does is provide another ideological and perhaps legal tool for attempts to silence Palestine solidarity work, which has been going on for years, decades, really. And we're seeing this play out in with the IHRA in jurisdictions that are using its definition. Events have been canceled or threatened with cancellation. People have been threatened with discipline on campuses, students and faculty alike, on the basis of this dubious IHRA definition. So to give just a couple of more of examples from many, frankly, ludicrous and obscene ones. Following Israeli bombings of Gaza and the anti-Semitic massacre of Jewish worshipers at Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue, Berkeley University Students for Justice in Palestine and their Jewish for Peace chapters planned to hold a joint vigil. However, the morning was canceled because of backlash that included a claim made by an attorney called Joel Siegel, claiming that according to the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, jointly mourning the bombing of Gaza and the anti-Semitic massacre in Pittsburgh was, according to some kind of logical gymnastics, a form of anti-Semitism. So we're in this bizarre world where mourning a massacre of Jewish people somehow becomes a form of anti-Semitism. To give another instance, the U.S. Department of Education opened an investigation into UCLA's Dr. Rabab Abdulladi's work on the interrelations of Zionism, colonialism, and Islamophobia. The IHRA definition is being used here to suggest that Abdulladi's remarks may have been anti-Semitic, even though her comments do not mention Jewish people. So again, we're in this strange hall of mirrors where a person can be faced with, not just a person, but a distinguished scholar can be faced with accusations of anti-Semitism when they have not even, you know, brought up Jewish people into the conversation. To give an example regarding students or another campus event, I should say, to give an example from the UK, Manchester University censored the title of a talk by a Jewish Holocaust survivor named Marika Sherwood. The original name for the talk was, quote, "You're doing to the Palestinians what the Nazis did to me." But this title apparently breached the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. And therefore, what we saw here was a Jewish Holocaust survivor supposedly carrying out an act of anti-Semitic hate speech by basically speaking out what she saw as a violation of the never again principle. I won't belabor this point by listing every case because there's a distressingly long list of them. But anyone who is interested can see the exhaustive summary that IJV published under the title IHRA Definition at Work. There are many examples of, you know, people running for student union leadership or campus leadership being harassed and bullied in a similar manner to those that I've just listed. So I don't think our analysis of these and similar cases should be solely framed in terms of liberal conceptions of free speech and academic freedom. The incidents I've been describing also illustrate the most straightforward cost of applying the IHRA definition to institutions of higher education. It gives those who side with colonialism an additional weapon to wield against students, faculties, and other campus workers who side with anti-colonial liberation. So this is about a power struggle, and the IHRA is being deployed as a tool in that power struggle. So that's significant, not only because is it a threat to students whose funding and entire education could be jeopardized because they support Palestinian rights to national self-determination. And it's significant not only because the livelihoods of people who work on campuses are under threat, including those of us who are contract faculty and lack the job security of tenured professors, though we've seen cases where even tenured professors are not safe. It's all of this is also significant because universities are themselves sites of political contestation, where public conceptions of truth and justice are incubated. And this is especially important in our era because campuses are one of the few sites of activist ferment that is left after neoliberalism has hollowed out so much of our political culture and depoliticized so many of our public spaces. There is not, and nor should there be, I would argue, a meaningful distinction between where one's pro-Palestine solidarity ends and where one's teaching and studying begins. Denying access to campus spaces that are required to plan and hold Palestine solidarity events is one way in which the kind of work and life that we have on campuses can be interfered with if anti-Zionism is construed as as being a form of anti-Semitism, or if even criticism of Israel that doesn't go to the degree of to the extent of anti-Zionism, is if that's construed as anti-Semitism. Furthermore, denying access to money through organizations like student unions, staff and faculty unions, or other campus groups such as PIRGs, the public interest research groups that exist on many campuses across Canada. It would be cut. These types of funds, access to them could be cut off should more and more universities come to adopt the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. That would make it vastly more difficult to put on quality Palestine solidarity events because these funds are needed to cover speakers' travel costs, for promotional materials, for audiovisual equipment, for the renting of space, and so on and so forth. This kind of repression extends to events whose purpose can simply be to educate people about Palestine, Israel. So we've seen efforts at University of Western Ontario a few years ago to prevent Ilan Pape from speaking. He is a Jewish Israeli scholar who has done a great deal, much like Norma Salah, to expose the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine on which Israel was created. This is, rigorous scholarship that the public ought to be informed about if it is to understand Palestine, Israel. But, an event like this comes under fire, and this is the kind of thing that we'll see more of if IHRA's definition of anti-Semitism is allowed to take hold on campuses. I emphasize here that universities are not only for their students, faculties, and staff. At least that's not what they are supposed to be. Universities are supposedly also for the broader public. So stifling or impeding the quality of Palestine-oriented educational events also deprives the larger communities in which campuses are situated of opportunities to get an accurate understanding of the past and present colonization of Palestine. So thus, beyond the immediate concrete problems, there are also these bigger picture implications that come along with post-secondary schools adopting the IHRA definition. And it seems I'm out of time, but I can elaborate on these in the question and answer session if anyone wants. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Greg. And I'm going to be now opening up the Q&A section. So we're going to be taking some questions from the public that have been rolling in as each panelist was speaking. So the first question is, this is going to be to all panelists, and I know Faisal wanted to answer this. So how do you respond to the narratives that the claim Zionism in itself is not the problem? But how it is applied today?
I understand that question to be kind of what's the state of liberal Zionism? And I think it's fair to say that liberal Zionism is dead. The idea that you could have a state that is both Jewish and democratic has never really seemed plausible to me. And there's lots of people who have always felt that statement or that description of Israel is not accurate. But certainly with the adoption of the nation state law, Israel has itself admitted through that instrument that the reality that has long existed de facto has now made it law that Israel is a state for the Jews. And the fact that there is an indigenous Palestinian minority there is not something that can be reconciled with the predominant ideology of the state. And you see it in the way that Palestinian parties, the Arab List, the so-called Arab List within the Israeli Knesset, rejects that the very Zionist foundation of the state and is therefore boycotted in shenanigans leading to the formation of government. The political crisis that existed in Israel's political system for months, for the entire year, basically, was to a large extent produced by the fact that nobody would form a government with the Palestinian parties. So Palestinians are actually excluded from Israeli democracy through the workings of the Israeli democratic system. Furthermore, Peter Beinart, probably one of the most ethical liberal Zionists around, has rejected his conception of Zionism, that conception of liberal Zionism that calls for a two-state solution and that is based on the idea of separation or apartheid as between Israelis and Palestinians. People of conscience are recognizing and have been recognizing at their own pace what has been true for since at least 1999, when Edward Said visited the region and proclaimed the two-state solution dead. So with the death of the two-state solution, I think dies liberal Zionism. And so now the question is, how can Zionism, the ideal of Jews having a safe place in the world to live and to be citizens in a country that is in some way shaped by a Jewish identity, how can that be realized in a shared environment with Palestinians? And that is a goal to which we should all aspire. But that requires a complete rethinking of Zionism.
What I would like to add is, once again, I'm always gravitated towards history. To go back to the history of Zionism itself, from the initial formation. The initial formation was literally that this is a movement interested in settling in Palestine. When the 1917 Balfour Declaration was signed, it was signed with, supposedly a moderate Zionist. And it was signed by, a liberal Zionist. And the idea was to establish an independent Jewish state or entity on Palestinian land. So from the very beginning, embedded in this Zionist idea was settler colonialism, was the grabbing of land. And not only that, that Zionist movement itself from the beginning adopted what is known in Hebrew, can be translated into English as Jewish land, market, Jewish market, and Jewish labor, meaning that all of these three major elements that make a state will be exclusively for Jews. And they, from the very initial beginning, they excluded Palestinians from the Palestinian labor market, from their land, from their places. So from the initial establishment of Zionism, Zionism was a settler colonial movement. Now that it was, if you want, renamed or rebranded as a national movement for the Jews, it definitely did not talk about, the Jews in the world. It did not talk about the Arab Jews who at one point until the 90s became, Israel's overwhelming majority, Arab Jews and others. And these are the ones that were also racialized by the state itself. So I cannot really see Zionism other than what it was. My speak or my beliefs are not just based on the books and on my research for the last 30, 40 years. I am from there. I am a Palestinian with an Israeli passport that lived there, went through education and system, and knew how we were educated in schools, but also at the universities. So I come with, a baggage, if you want, of experience that says a lot about the state of Israel and about its ideology, namely Zionism, regardless of what is being spoken about this side of Zionism or that trend of Zionism.
We'll be moving on to the next question, which is, for someone working in a university that deemed their panel discussion anti-Semitic after applying the IHRA definition, what practical steps can I do to challenge this? My university has banned the Israeli Apartheid Week and now criticisms of Israel.
So I can say a couple things about that since I was talking about campuses. And I think the first step would be to, you know, forgive me if you've done some of this already, but build as broad of a coalition as possible with other groups on campus. This, of course, would include other student groups that might be sympathetic, but also campus unions. In my experience, unions of contract faculty tend to be better on this, as do non-academic staff and their unions, so tradespeople, for example. Nevertheless, it's not at all, it's far from impossible to find support for students doing events like Israeli Apartheid Week from tenured faculty, even if their entire union as a whole won't speak up. Sometimes they will, but I find those to be few and far between. Equally important is to seek off-campus allies. As we're, I think, seeing based on today's panelists and the people who are attending, the Palestinian Solidarity Movement exists in Canada from coast to coast, and it exists around the world, of course. So it may feel like you're operating in isolation if you're a handful of students at a campus somewhere in Canada trying to put on an Israeli Apartheid Week or similar event, and you're under attack, but you're not alone. There is this whole international network that you can plug into, and a reasonable starting point, or one starting point among many, would be to get in touch with Faculty for Palestine, which is where I'm from. And one of the things that we seek to do is support students, and we have done our best in previous cases to support students who are being besieged, figuratively speaking, for their efforts to support anti-colonial struggles. So please do reach out to us, as well as perhaps some of the other resources that I've mentioned.
Palestinian peace negotiator Saeb Erekat, the Secretary General of the Palestine Liberation Organization, has died at the age of 65 after he became infected with COVID-19. Erekat was a key Palestinian negotiator involved in peace talks for over 3 decades. He famously showed up at the 1991 Madrid conference proudly wearing a keffiyeh, a symbol of Palestinian nationalism. He stood in staunch opposition to Trump's Middle East plan, which he called the fraud of the century, and condemned recent agreements. This is Saeb Erekat speaking in 2018.
I think as Palestinians, we have defined our interest, as no one benefits more from achieving peace than us, and nobody stands to lose more in the absence of peace more than us.
Erekat is survived by his wife, 4 children, and 8 grandchildren. The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called Erekat a great fighter who had a great role in raising the banner of Palestine high and defending the rights of our people in all international forums, unquote. Abbas has declared 3 days of mourning in Palestinian Authority-ruled areas of the Israeli-occupied West. Of the death of Saeb Erekat, of COVID-19, he lived in the West Bank. He had a lung transplant here in the United States in 2017, was extremely vulnerable, and the loss of what it means politically.
Yeah, good morning, Amy, and thank you for having me on. Let me just begin by extending my condolences to the entire Erekat family, who lost Dr. Saeb Erekat today at the age of 65 after losing a very difficult battle with COVID. As you noted, he's had a previous lung transplant and was obviously in a very difficult condition to try to fight off this virus. You know, as I think about, you know, the life and contributions of Saab Erekat, you know, I note that I and others certainly had differences with him in terms of political vision and strategy. But one must really reflect and admire the tireless commitment he had to communicating the Palestinian cause as he best saw fit, and really reflect on the longevity of the career and, you know, the important voice that he brought to the conversation at a time when, you know, many people around the world had not really heard from Palestinians, particularly Palestinians living in Palestine on the ground, effectively communicating about the Palestinian cause in the English language. You know, I note a important program that he was on as early as 1988 with ABC's Ted Koppel at the time on Nightline, doing a special on the situation on the ground in Palestine. Of course, that time during the intifada that was taking place, really gripping the world as it is, as it turned its eyes to Palestine for the first time in quite some time. And he, along with Hanan Ashrawi and others, represented this generation of Palestinian leaders, educators, intellectuals, civil society figures who were communicating the Palestinian cause to the world at a very, very important time. So, you know, his passing, obviously his career, you know, in speaking for Palestinians and about Palestinians globally only continued on from there. You know, I think this this moment in his passing really represents something of a moment of transition from that generation and from that and from that time.
So that's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
The COVID-19 pandemic in Canada is serious. We must continue to practice all public health measures. Follow local guidelines for gatherings, maintain physical distancing, wash your hands, wear a mask, and download the COVID Alert app. If you have symptoms, even mild ones, stay home. Protect yourself and others. Learn more at canada.ca/coronavirus or 1-833-784-4397. A message from the Government of Canada.
CKUT Radio.
Radio. Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
When your parents need your help, you're there. When your kids say something's wrong, you're there. When your friends have a rough day, you're there. Be there for yourself the way you're there for others, as it's normal for these uncertain times to bring out negative emotions or anxiety. If you're finding it difficult to carry out daily tasks, there are solutions. Visit quebec.ca/gettingbetter or call Info Sociale 811. a message from the gouvernement du Québec.